Welcome to this ABC Radio National podcast. For more on other enjoyable and informative programs, listen after the end for details. But right now, here's your podcast, which we hope you enjoy.
Welcome now to Hindsight. Michelle Rayner joining you with a feature today which uncovers the little-known experience of a generation of young women who in the 1960s and 70s were incarcerated by the state in an old jail in the small New South Wales country town of Hay. Four decades on from these events, former inmates, their families, and the local townsfolk of Hay are trying to reconcile this past. For this feature, producer Anne Arnold went along to a reunion, which has helped open the book on this largely hidden chapter in Australia's welfare history. Here's Exposed to Moral Danger.
At the time, we were told these girls were the 10 worst girls in New South Wales.
They didn't ask why did I swear at the officer. In all the years in and out, same with my friends, no one ever asked why.
They were, you know, used to scream out and cry, and yeah, the cries were shocking. Yeah, and my daughter, Debbie, she used to say, oh, those poor girls, and, can't you get them, can't you get them? And I said, you can't do nothing, darling.
This is the town of Hay on the vast open plains of southwestern New South Wales. For hundreds of girls in the 1960s and early 70s, Hay represented dread, the ultimate punishment.
We saw girls come back from Hay, and what we saw, they were just like broken. They had no spirit, their eyes were down, their hair was cropped up. And there was a constant fear all the time that we were in Parramatta that we would be sent there, and we just knew that this was some horror place.
Adolescent girls were committed to the Parramatta Girls' Home in Western Sydney by the courts. Most were deemed neglected and exposed to moral danger. Some had also committed criminal offences. At Parramatta, there was a prevailing climate of fear and random cruelty from some of those in charge. But in the 1960s, a new threat was introduced.
Arrangements are well advanced for the acquisition and adaptation of premises well away from Sydney, to which very difficult or unruly girls may be transferred from Parramatta.
I remember one incident in particular. They took the girl. You can't forget the screams. They came in the middle of the night to take her out of isolation. And
at Parramatta, she'd been in isolation.
And the next morning, the superintendent pulled us out, and he said to us, Margaret told everybody that I interfered with her. He said, I interfered with her, all right. I interfered with her sleep. She's on a train to Hay, and if you want to do the same, you'll find yourself there.
Lynette Aitken, who was in Parramatta Girls' Home in the early 1960s. The Hay Institution for Girls had been expedited after Parramatta began to implode.
More than 20 screaming, hysterical girls defied police and fire brigade officers from a rooftop at Parramatta Girls' Industrial. The fire brigade turned hoses on the girls as thousands of people gathered to watch the incident. The girls screamed abuse at police. The girls threw tiles and rocks. A near hysterical woman who said she had a daughter. She said her daughter, age 16, had made several attempts to escape. The last of the girls came off the police roof. Said the girls' language was disgusting. Daily Telegraph, February 25th, 1961.
More riots followed. A senior staff member was suspended for alleged disgraceful or improper conduct. The New South Wales government was urged to hold a public inquiry into circumstances at Parramatta. Instead, it created the Hay Institution.
The building, originally a jail, has been unoccupied for many years and was shabby and unkempt. It has now been completely transformed. Broken paths, rank grass and accumulated rubbish have been replaced by trim lawns, gay flower beds and flourishing vegetable gardens.
Mr. F.H. Hawkins, Minister for Child Welfare, Annual Report, June 1962.
In 1961, I was 16 years old. I was drugged and I was brought to here for 3 months. I worked like a man. There was a lady here called Mrs. Green, and she used to feed us biscuits on the floor when we were on scrubbing the floor duty. We would find some biscuits hidden by Mrs. Green, and I was so hungry that I licked my finger and picked the crumbs for those biscuits.
The thing that I could not bear was that they were given arduous jobs to do, like making concrete paths all around inside the perimeter of the jail walls. And when they came to the end, having completed all these beautifully made concrete paths, they were handed pickaxes and told to rip them up to start again. And I complained to the authority about that and said I thought that was a terribly negative way to treat them.
Mary Smith is now 87. She worked night shifts at the institution for a year in 1962. Over the 14 years that girls were sent to Hay, Mary and other local women were employed as officers in a support role to the male management. The men were initially brought down from the harsh, militaristic Tamworth boys' home, which Hay was intended to emulate. Eyes down, the girls were told constantly.
Move!
They had to march, not walk. And they could only talk to each other during 2 10-minute sessions, one in the morning, one in the afternoon. They were never to touch each other.
The institution can accommodate 14 girls, with 9 or 10 the normal figure. This one-to-one staff-inmate ratio enables a degree of individual attention that is out of the question at Parramatta, but which is needed to achieve any lasting change of attitude in the few extremely antisocial girls who are opposed to all authority.
Certainly sometimes, when they first arrived there, they were very hard to control. There was no emphasis at all on rehabilitation. It was all on obedience and discipline. They could not address the people who worked there, known as officers, unless they put up their hands, as in school, and said, "Reporting to you, Mrs. Smith, may I go to the toilet?" Things like that. And it was demeaning in a way, and it was strictly enforced, but it was something they had not been used to ever doing, obeying people in charge, and they found it very difficult when they first came here.
I was skinny like a pretzel, and they kept me that way and kept me under control by taking my food. I think I had more food tonight than I did the whole 3 months I was in Hay.
At the first ever reunion of Hay Girls in March this year, Joy Crane was among half a dozen women to address an audience of friends, family and local people at a dinner inside the courtyard of the old sandstone jail.
When I arrived here, I wasn't allowed to look at anyone. I remember the officer's feet and his brown boots. And because I couldn't look at people, I would naturally, automatically, when someone spoke, look. And therefore I went without meals.
The punishments for doing the wrong thing began with no pudding with their meal, and if they were very recalcitrant, they had no pudding the next day. If they really played up, and by that I mean physically attacking or attempting to attack, smashing or attempting to smash furniture, etc., one girl managed to heave a chair 12 feet into the air and smash the fluorescent lights in the dining room one night, and it took 3 men to subdue her. She was dragged away to the isolation cell, which is a little solitary cell about 8 feet square, and they were locked up there for 24 hours, in which time they only had 3 cups of water and 3 slices of bread. If they were still recalcitrant. They had another 24 hours.
At Hay, each girl is treated as a special case and given individual training. This is one of the three main principles underlying the institution's regime.
My name's Marlene Riley. I was in the first lot of girls to come here to Hay. They cut my hair off. I had a ringlet right down to my breast. This man just came up and said, "You've got lovely hair," and cut my ringlet off. I fought him, and I was a little girl. I was 5 foot. So there was another Marlene that came here, and he said, "Well, you won't be called Marlene anymore. Your name will be your second name. Now you'll be known as June."
I was on duty at night. Very few of the girls ever saw me, only if they had toothache or anything, and then they only saw me through the round hole in the door. I used to have to give them aspirins and
Were you able to, because you were a nurse as well, were you able to sort of speak with them and comfort them when you were doing that?
I tried. Now, this was, of course, strictly against the rules. We were all told we weren't to converse with the girls. But I do remember quite a few incidents when girls had toothache or perhaps it was period pain and they couldn't sleep and they would ramble on telling me about how they got themselves into the prison system. And one particular girl I've never forgotten told me she'd been on the docks at Woolloomooloo earning her living since she was 9. And so I used to just try to assure them that they had to do their time here, but to try, for goodness sake, to stay out of trouble. But I could never see a great deal of hope for them.
They have in my file that the training, as they called it here, it didn't work with me. They kept me here for 9 months, but their training didn't work. Why did they continue on for years with the same system? Why did they wait for at least another 10 years and then bring my young sister up here and put her through the same thing?
And the other thing that upset me at the time, I know very few could read and write. I offered for some extra money to go back there and try to teach them to read and write. Because a girl that can't read and write had no opportunity of a decent job.
Mary Smith's offer was not taken up by the authorities.
The second principle is strict discipline. Many of the girls come from homes where discipline is entirely lacking, and in later years they had learned to defy or evade all attempts at control. Such a background tends to produce instability, and the firm discipline at Hay not only teaches a respect for law and order, but also helps to counter the insecurity that lies behind so much delinquent behaviour.
Minister Hawkins, annual report, June 1962.
Hello. Hello, how are you, love? Yeah. I'm Wilma Nesbitt, and I've lived here all my life, yes.
And when you say here, you mean right at this house?
Right at this house all my life. I'm 63 years old, yeah.
So, and you're
my
the
mother. I'm the baby of 15. Yes.
You can see the jail from here.
Yes. We used to, you know, hear the girls of a night time and first thing of a morning. It was some mornings it was really cruel to hear them crying and screaming out. You'd swear that some nights that they were being hurt, you know, but I don't know. I couldn't say because everything was locked down really tight. Wasn't very nice to hear, I can tell you. Yeah.
To the best of my knowledge, they were never physically abused, but again, I was only there 1 year.
Well, in them days we had no air conditioning. We used to lay out here on old shearers' beds on the front lawn until all hours of the morning, you know, but you could hear them with no problem. And all I know, my mum complained a couple of times to the council, and they said, "Look, there's nothing, Kate, that you can do about it. It's run by the institute."
Do you have any copies of letters that your mother wrote? Or
no, love, I haven't. No, my mother couldn't read and write anyway, properly. But she used to work on all these committees, like the hospital committees and things like that. And she used to always worry about the girls.
They had to do something bad at Parramatta to be sent to Hay. we were told they were the 10 worst girls in New South Wales.
In the year 1961-62, when Mary Smith worked at the jail, as it was always known in Hay, the majority of girls admitted to Parramatta Girls' Home were categorised as neglected, 155 of them. Among the other complaints and charges, the most serious were 9 cases of break, enter and steal. Once in Parramatta, girls could be transferred to Hay for a range of behaviours, from lesbianism to violence and other forms of defiance.
And we were warned not to turn our backs on them at all. You had to keep them subjugated all the time so that they couldn't, you know, get the upper hand. But there were only a few incidents when it came to physically restraining them. If they were told they had to go in the isolation cell, well, they didn't go willingly.
I'm Eileen. I was in Parramatta.
Eileen Atkins was at Hay in its first year, 1961. She'd not had contact with any former Hay girls before the reunion. She drove from Adelaide at the urging of her 4 sisters who'd also been in care but not at Hay. They and some of Eileen's children and grandchildren gathered at the reunion to support her.
I came from Albury in New South Wales, and the second time round I was sent to Tempe, Catholic place in Sydney, where I absconded from with several others, so we ended up back in Parramatta. And I was in admission when the girls, for the second time, rioted over in the main hall, or whatever you like to call it. So we went along with them in admission. Up on the roofs, whatever, fire hoses to get us down, you know. Anyhow, ended up in Long Bay Jail, 16 for 3 months. Okay, 3 months up. I thought, hey, I'm going back to Parramatta, I'll go home. No, I didn't go home.
Instead of going home, Eileen was on the way to Hay, a journey which included a road accident.
Anyhow, we had to wait there for another wagon to bring us here to Hay. Bugger me dead if it wasn't the same bloke driving. I thought, God, he's going to kill us. So, sounds funny, you know, and I'm trying to make the most of it, which I have through my life, you know. But I was here for 9 months, and the sadness, the brutality or whatever, and whether people believe you or not, you know, and I have heard that people of Hay, going back at that time when we have heard the screams and yells from us girls of what happened. Well, I can actually tell you that I was raped in this place. That window there is a toilet. And that is where Mr. Green had his, and he was a big man, and he had his arm across my throat, and he raped me there, and there, and there, in my cell. Why didn't we say anything? Who would have bloody believed us back then, you know? Would have been told bullshit, you know? And I know there's only a couple of girls here tonight that remember me, and there's only a couple of girls that I do know back from that time. I won't mention their names, but I think they know. And whether they know that happened to me or not, I can also say there was another girl here, went into Hay Hospital, had her appendix taken out. This was sick bay at the time. And she came home the same day she had her appendix taken out, and she was raped by Mr. Kennedy, right? And we all know that, right? So the sadness and the hardship that went in on this place is unbelievable. And whether people believe us today or not, I don't really care. I don't give a bugger, because I know in my mind I'm not mad. I know this did happen.
I wish to ask the Vice President of the Executive Council whether it is a fact that the old maximum security jail at Hay, considered many years ago to be unfit for felons, has been converted into a punitive institution for wayward girls from the Parramatta Training School.
Anne Press was a member of the New South Wales Upper House, one of three women there in 1962. She came from Condoblin in western New South Wales and began to raise concerns about the new Hay Institution for Girls. Hers was a lone voice.
Is it true that the girls are spirited away from Parramatta in the night and that they arrive at Hay? Is it a fact also that the girls are locked in the old cells, the only ventilation in which is an opening measuring 2 feet 6 inches by 12 inches, situated 8 feet from the floor? Is the minister aware that many Hay people have commented on the frightful screams emerging from the cells? And that when will the minister assure himself that the Department of Child Welfare of New South Wales is not being party to a form of cruelty from which every decent person recoils?
The Attorney General, Reg Downing, replied the next day. An influential Labor Party figure, he was lauded as a prison reformer. Sydney's Downing Centre Court Complex is named after him. On this occasion, he was briefed by Mr. Hawkins, the Minister for Child Welfare, and reported,
"There has been no question of punitive treatment in the segregation of this small group. Rather, the emphasis has been placed on supervision, guidance and individual attention."
His colleagues in the lower house, where there were no women, went further.
The Sydney Morning Herald, May the 4th, 1962. Girls' home allegations, imagination. The Minister for Child Welfare, Mr. F.H. Hawkins, yesterday denied allegations by a woman MLC of ill treatment of inmates at the Hay Girls' Home. He said the allegations were a figment of the members' imagination. Mrs. A.E. Press, one of the Labor rebels in the Legislative Council on Wednesday, asked whether the girls were locked in cells, formerly part of an... In the Legislative Assembly yesterday, Mr. W.M. Rigby, Labor Hurstville, asked whether the allegations were merely the hysterical and irresponsible ranting of an embittered person whose only desire is press publicity at the government's expense. "This member is not as renowned for stability or reliability as she is for exaggeration," he said.
"Well, we've had a special request to just slightly interrupt the way the flow goes. The girls want Sharon. Sharon Crystal, where are you? Okay, Sharon. The moment is yours, Sharon. It is time for these women to take back their place.
To carry on, you light up my day."
At the end of 1962, the superintendent at Hay, Percy Green, was removed from his position. The institute continued for another 12 years, as did the abuses. The girls, meanwhile, frequently won awards at the Hay Show for craft, vegetables and flowers. This was always mentioned in the Minister for Child Welfare's annual report.
Thank you so much, you're so lovely, I feel better now. I want to say that in this journey, you have no idea what we've been through in this last 24 hours. You just don't know. We were all little kids, you know, 15, 16 years old, and we went through this place, and I think, if we can do this, girls, we can do anything.
Sharon Crystal has made a career of singing on cruise ships. She was 16-year-old Sharon O'Brien when she was sent to Hay in 1965.
I was one of the few girls who, if any, I don't know of any other girls who got out of here for a day out, but I had a toothache and I desperately needed to go to the dentist, and eventually after pleading and having a very swollen mouth, they took me off to the dentist, and I went with Mr. and Mrs. Hockley, who were a married couple of officers, and I marched out of here and went in their car and marched right in the main street of Hay into the dentist. And Mrs.
And when you say marched?
Marched, as in march, stomp, you know, feet, knees up and swinging like a little German soldier. And Mrs. Hockley put her hand on my arm and said, "Sharon, you don't need to do that here." But it was so hard to get out of the habit of doing that. And I'm sure that the good citizens of Hay were wondering what this poor child was doing. But I went to the dentist, and then Mr. and Mrs. Hockley took me for a little tour around Hay, and it was really pretty. It was a really nice day out. Yeah, it was good. But so the standout memories for me are the good ones, like Christmas Day. I had a fabulous Christmas Day here. I woke up to hear singing and thought I'd had lost my mind. I thought, oh yeah, right.
On that Christmas Day, pop songs were being played over the jail loudspeakers.
And the officer said, "Good morning and Merry Christmas, Sharon, and today is Christmas Day and you can relax." And so six little girls came out of those dreadful, dreadful cells and with our eyes down, and the officer said, "No, it's Christmas Day, you can relax, just go and have a good day." Sort of came to each other and there were hugs and jumping up and down, and then we came running around out here and we realised we could run around, and the officers brought their children, they gave us a fabulous Christmas lunch and we all played ball games and were generally silly little teenage girls, and it was great fun. It was really, really good fun, and we had presents from home, and so Christmas Day in Hay was quite wonderful. But it was bizarre because the next day it was straight back to the routine of marching and you know.
All right, move.
You're with Hindsight on ABC Radio National. I'm Anne Arnold, and we're revisiting the Hay Institution for Girls in southwestern New South Wales.
Where have you been hiding yourself?
Fancy you've
been
hiding
yourself. I've been looking for you,
darling.
Oh,
God bless you. God's good to see you. Oh, dear. Emotional, isn't it?
28 former Hay girls, about a third of them Aboriginal, and many more supporters made the long journey back for the reunion weekend, which was organised by a support group called the Para Girls and a group of Hay women. Most came on an overnight bus from Sydney. Others travelled from as far as Darwin. Local girl Imogen Gardam played the flute as they arrived at the Sandstone Jail on a blazing hot Saturday morning. She's 14, the same age as some of the younger girls sent to Hay.
1974, I was here.
What's your name?
Margaret Chidsey.
I know you.
Yeah.
You're looking very young.
Yeah.
Oh,
thank you.
You're a baby when you're here. Is your daughter?
Yeah.
Oh, I love you.
Effie Ray is a former officer from Hay, and she's maintained contact with some of the Hay girls. The women are now mostly in their 50s. Effie waited in a chair under the stone archway and offered each a single rose.
Hello.
How are you?
Do I know you?
No.
Oh, darling.
Probably not.
What years were you here?
62.
No.
Yeah.
Take it anyway.
I will.
Yeah.
That's nice.
Effie worked there for 7 years in the late 60s and early 70s in the lead-up to the institution's closure.
I found that your tone of voice in the morning when they called out to, you know, get up and all that sort of stuff, your tone of voice was never threatening.
Oh, no.
No, you still made us stick to the rules, but yeah. you weren't that... Some of them were so sadistic, even the way they spoke. Oh, Mrs. Maxwell, oh, my God. She was the devil herself.
Used to throw me the most was that I would leave home at 2 o'clock. I would have left afternoon tea and milk and that sort of thing for my children, and then they would go to the pool and I'd come up here and you'd be stuck in that hot workroom. You know, that's the thing that
and
really...
And then what aprons at the... canvas aprons.
Remember,
I was allergic to... semolina,
yeah.
And I made you eat it anyway.
Yeah.
And I got up on the table to the air vent and I'm trying to spoon the semolina through the holes and it clogged all the holes up. And I was packing it for a week in case somebody noticed.
And nobody did.
Oh, I was terrified, absolutely terrified.
Staying close by Effie Ray throughout the arrivals at the jail was Maureen McKernan.
I know, it's a bit of a rat bag, wasn't I? I was only violent to myself.
Yeah.
And then I put that nail in my leg,
yeah.
3-inch nail.
Why did you do that?
They charged me with stealing government property because I pulled it. I pulled it out of the kitchen window behind the cell block. Yeah. I put it in my leg, shoved it in my leg up to the top, and it was in there for about 3 days.
Still
just defiance. See, in Parramatta, it was common practice to stick pins in yourself when you were frustrated or angry. And they used to check it when we came here, they check our mouth for pins.
When I first came here, I said, "What's the matter?" to this girl. She said, "Poor to you, Mrs. Ray. My pins are hurting." I said, "So am mine." I thought she meant her legs. And,
I put 96 in jail. I stayed bad for a while.
Yeah.
Mm. I finally discovered that I was bipolar.
Oh, wow.
So, it explains a lot of the behaviour,
After leaving Hay and Parramatta, Maureen made 8 suicide attempts.
I was devastated. I was 18, and I'd had, in 8 weeks, I'd had like nearly 2,000 stitches in my arms.
From?
From cutting myself with razor blades. See, I wasn't bad or anything. I was sick. Because my entire life changed once I was diagnosed and given the lithium. My whole entire life just changed. Yeah, and if it had happened earlier, then my whole life would have been different. So, they were useless. The psychiatrists they had were absolutely useless.
Girls were supposed to be assessed for mental fitness before being sent to Hay.
Well, it was 3 of us, and we all got our records. And did you know that the psychiatrist wrote word for word the same thing on all of our records? Word for word. The only difference was our name.
The legislation didn't distinguish between delinquent and neglected children.
Professor Kerry Carrington is the Chair of Sociology at the University of New England. She wrote a book called Offending Girls.
It was more likely the case that if you were in fact before the court for a non-criminal offence that is a welfare matter, you were more likely to be committed to an institution than if you had in fact stolen a car or committed a crime. Girls could be put in homes for simply being sexually promiscuous or simply being sexually active or being uncontrollable or being exposed to moral danger or simply being on the street and being perceived as being a risk or immoral.
What was the thinking, do you think? Why was there a belief that life would be better for them in an institution?
We call this penal welfareism. It was a whole kind of an ethos that encapsulated the welfare bureaucracies from the 1930s right through to the 1980s. And that whole ethos was really about removing children from the source of contamination. The intention here was really about removing girls from their families. It was about punishing families who were from impoverished backgrounds, public housing areas, Aboriginal reserves in particular. And, of course, they would justify this as being in the best interests of the child. But, of course, it was the young girls who paid the price for absolutely no fault of their own.
Do you remember Lizzie Bateman?
Yeah.
Well, Lizzie Bateman, when I came in the first time, which was 1969...
These days, Maureen McKernan sparkles with life and has a great memory. Her arms are covered in the scarred remnants of tattoos.
They did have tattoos there, but when I was in Parramatta the last time, they got word from the Navy of how to get rid of tattoos by rubbing salt on it. So they needed a guinea pig, and I was at the time in trouble, as usual, and they said that they would give me a cushy job if I did this with the salt, so I did.
And what'd you do with the salt?
Well, you just get the salt, and like a friend of mine held the skin tight, and you just keep putting plenty of salt on and rubbing till you've broken the skin over the whole tattoo.
What are you rubbing with?
Just your fingers. Then when you've broken the skin over the whole lot, you just keep going. You just keep putting it on and rubbing it, trying to get as deep as you can. Then when you get a scab and that comes off, your tattoo comes off with the scab.
She'd been in and out of care most of her life, along with her friend Christina Green.
We knew each other in like 5 different homes, right from when we were 5 and a half. I was 5 and a half. We were in Bajura together, then we were in up in Newcastle in King Edward together, then we were in Ormond together, then Parramatta together, then we went down Hay together and all this,
Maureen was and is still angry that she was ever sent to Parramatta.
Like, I was in there because I went to the welfare and told them my stepfather was sexually abusing me and had since I was 6. Could they help me get into a hostel or something, you know, so I could get a job and that. And instead, next minute I found myself in waiting to go to court and go into a home. I mean, that rage is what made me play up for all that time. I just went. Well, I couldn't trust anyone. How can you trust any kind of government person after that?
Maureen was at Hay in the early 1970s. The management wanted to send her back to Parramatta, but could only do that if she had a record of good behaviour. They found a way to get that clean record: isolation.
The worst thing was that last 5 weeks when that I spent in a cell. And 5 weeks is a long time to be in a tiny room. No exercise, not seeing outside, no fresh air. The boredom alone is enough to drive you nuts, because you've got nothing. No, and there's no bed or anything like that either. It's just a room.
Sleep on the floor?
No, I used to drag a night time. I'd drag, which was made by us, a canvas mattress thing that had straw in it. And the first time you go to isolation, you really had 3 blankets. But the second time, you only had 2. And all the times after that, you only had 1. So I only had 1 blanket. There's no such thing as sheets or anything, just a blanket. That was it.
Were you not let outside once in that 5 weeks?
No. I never left the cell block. I went down to the end of the cell block, and he got me to look up at the sky and asked me if I could see the sun. And I said, yes. He said, right, now back. Because the rules said that anyone locked in segregation was supposed to get some sun, just so he could write down that he did it, you know. See, the only reason I was locked up is because so that they could write down that I was being good. And because I left there to go back to Parramatta straight from segregation, which is like unheard of.
Because you'd gone pretty wild in the lead up to that.
Oh, yeah, they wanted to get rid of me real bad because I was ruining their reputation. You know, because I wasn't scared of the place. And once you take that fear away, the other girls, you can't use it to make them behave.
Maureen was also reluctant to leave Hay because there she had Effie Ray as an officer.
Now, Maureen said this morning, I could remember Mrs. Ray, you'd say, turn the shower on really fast so she could speak to me. I particularly wanted to see Maureen. I had already seen Christina, but I wanted to see Maureen because she was treated so badly, and God love her, she said that the thought of me kept her going for many years.
How much did it mean to you to have a bit of kindness shown to you by her when you were in the institution?
It meant everything, absolutely everything. The only thing that got me through was when I went back to Parramatta and that, and officers were at you saying, you know, you're no good, you'll never be any good, you know, you're going to be in and out of jail all your life. I would remember her putting her job at risk to talk to me and think, well, if she was willing to do that, I must be a good person. You know, I can't be all bad. And that really, that I hung on to that. Otherwise, I think I really would have gone down emotionally, you know. Yeah, she was a wonderful woman.
If you tell me what happened back there, right towards the end of when you were greeting the former Hay girls.
Oh, well, I got a good reception from most of them, and then in the end, half a dozen or so walked out, might have been 85, and then one girl came back and handed the rose back because I was part of the system, you see, and I did nothing about it. Well, she wouldn't know what I did. And then she came back and apologised for why she had to do it. And I said, oh, that's all right. Very painful. You come back 2 or 3 more times and, you know, she might be healed more by then. Because I know it was very emotional for me, so I can imagine what it was like for the girls.
Why was it so emotional for you?
Well, because it was the system was bad, and I knew that from the word go. And I don't know how many times I wasn't going to leave, but I needed I had a family to bring up, I needed the money. But if I had left there, I hate to think who might have got my job. We walked in that door and we left our power behind. We were as much under the control of the mail officers as the girls were. But the worst part of it was to hear those cells lock at night. Yes. And one of the girls said, you know, that was just plain torture, banging on those, the locks on the door. And I said, well, it wasn't meant to be that. They had to be locked in, and then there were three of us there, myself, say, matron and the mail officer, and everybody had to check that that was locked. And then the putting the light, I'd look again at them every half hour. That was to be reassured that they were alive. But I think we could have done it with the torch, and there's a little peephole, and that's all I ever opened. And if they were facing the wall, I'd have to say, Mary, turn over. Because you didn't know whether they were dead or alive. So that really wasn't designed as torture, even though they felt that it was.
Sun Herald, 11th of May, 1962. The Sun Herald today reveals a bold, successful experiment to rehabilitate... One official said, the girls who go to Hay are real little toughs. The way they get themselves up, they could be anything from 15 years old to 50. But after a few months there, they have rosy cheeks and they have lost a lot of their fat. They are transformed into nice, healthy-looking schoolgirls. The training program at the institution... There must be no snarling, sneering or speaking out of the corner of the mouth. It's perfection we're after.
You seem to remember girls' names and incidents. You've obviously thought a lot
of them. Of course I have. Yeah, I've thought of a lot of them. I'll never forget what the day Barbara came, like I came to work and Barbara was black and blue, and I was a little girl, Elizabeth, an Aboriginal girl, and she was treated badly. None of this ever happened when I was there. But I knew the officer was on the night before, so I knew what happened.
Are either of those girls here this weekend?
Elizabeth's not. I think she's dead.
There's a lot of girls that have been through here and aren't here tonight because they've passed away. And I just want to, you know, like, just try and, you know, everyone to remember that some of the girls that got out of here committed suicide, and I lost a very close and dear friend, Rosalind Glass, that was here, a young Koori girl. She died at the age of 36 from diabetes because she became an alcoholic after getting out of here, you know.
And there was one girl called Rose. Now, I don't know what her proper name is, we just called her Rosie. And things happened there, and I was able to get her on her own and say, now, if you're... I'll do something about this, but no good me doing it if you're not going to agree. And she said, yes, she would. She's a tiny little thing that by that evening she was petrified, and she just said, thank you, Mrs. Robert. No, I can't. Just too frightened.
What do you think was happening to her?
Well, at one stage I thought she was in the big isolation, you know, the little room. She was there. And I believed somebody might have been coming in when I was on night duty, and you wouldn't know. And I got as mad as anybody in the end. I was tying bits of cotton on the gate, and if it was broken in the morning, I'd know somebody had been there, you know.
And there were days when the cotton was broken?
Yeah.
If a man was going to a girl's cell, wouldn't there have been screams and other noises?
Well, the girl... not necessarily would scream. She'd be fearful of retribution. And it could be said by that particular male that he heard the screaming and he rushed in. Thought, I tell you, your mind starts to work differently when you're working there.
Risking her job, Effie Ray did make a written complaint to the Department of Child Welfare about a man visiting a girl in her cell.
She received no reply. Then came a pivotal moment with witnesses.
I'd just come on afternoon duty and the two morning officers were going off. So there were two morning officers present. There was matron, there was a cook and myself coming on. That was five women and there would be perhaps three men there. And this girl, I'll see her face to this day, she must have done something. Oh, I suppose I didn't think it was that bad, but she was called out. She wouldn't apologise or would do what she was told to do. So they got in touch with the office for the manager. He walked, strode across the lawn and just flattened her. Just punched fair in the face. Down she went. I nearly died. But of course she didn't show it, didn't show any emotion, whatever.
Effie had one other colleague she trusted, Charlie. Together they wrote a letter about the incident. The manager was removed from Hay.
I'm Robin. I won't tell you my last name because at the moment I've forgot it. Yeah. We rebelled against the system. We really did. Like but we weren't as bad as what they said. We were kids, you know.
In here, can you see in here right at the very back, there's some scratchings.
Yeah, we all...
One of them's Ilwa, I-L-W-A, yes. Rhonda Kelso.
Worship and adore.
I love worship and adore.
That is our code. That was our code from Parramatta and here. Yes. That was our way. We used to sign our notes, remember? Yep. Either that or SWAC. Seal with a loving kiss. Those were ours.
Linwood Hall. I have no parents. I have no sisters. I have no brothers. I've only got my Parramatta sisters and my Hay sisters. And all my sisters, I love, worship and adore you. And I tell you what, for the rest of my life, I will love, worship and adore you, man. Because you're all I've got. I've got nobody else. I've got nothing in this world except you girls.
We now have the planting of the rose ceremony.
Any girls who want to throw some dirt in there?
On the Sunday of the reunion weekend, after the high emotions of the night before, a more subdued crowd gathered again for a ceremony. The lawn and rose gardens of the jail courtyard were at their prettiest, and the women seemed different.
This is precious, and the reason it's precious is because we're all here together planting a flower. There's just too much love in this place, and this is hell, it just isn't right, so that makes it precious.
What we're going to do now is we've got these candles here and we think they're very special for you. And ladies, you're invited to come up and take a candle and if you like, I mean, you don't have to, but I'll just give you a little blessing, nothing, you know, elaborate. If you don't wish to receive, that's okay, just take a candle and go. That's up to you. There's no pressure here today, I can assure you. And also, it's a symbol of hope. Okay?
Let it flow through me. Let it flow through me.
Every woman approached the district Catholic priest, Father Brian Ebert, and was embraced by him, some resting against his shoulder for a few moments, many of them weeping. The music was performed by three local women who sing in different churches.
Blowing out into the desert, setting all the Catholics free.
Back in 1962, Anne Press, the New South Wales parliamentarian, reported comments allegedly made by a Hay clergyman who was a personal friend of Mr Green, the superintendent.
The Reverend Burke told another minister, "Oh, don't go near the place. They're bad girls. Leave them to stew in their own juice." The Reverend Burke had a glorious opportunity to go in there and do something to help these girls. His wife could have gone in there and taught them. However, he preferred to drink his tea with his more comfortable parishioners and to look the other way.
Former Officer Effie Ray is now 78. Staff contracts forbade any discussion of the jail, and the women who work there have largely kept their experiences to themselves.
That disturbed me terribly, and I remember going to my priest and I said, I can't think of one thing that I did, but how come I have this terrible sense of guilt? And he said, F, because you were part of an evil system, that was it. He said, you were part of an evil system. And it was an evil system.
Dad, where do these go? You are growing so tall.
So we had lots of hugs and tears, and I just think, you know, it's such a terrible thing that those girls went through, and I really want them to leave Hay, and I think after tonight and listening to the girls that they will go away feeling much better.
Jenny Japp is the chairman of the Hay Jail Museum and was part of a small army of people who cooked and served food to the girls all weekend.
How soon can I turn this fridge back on now that I've got the
fridge? No, leave it off.
Jenny is a primary school teacher and remembers as a young parent in the 1960s going to the jail office to meet visiting government people when she and others were seeking funding for a preschool across the road.
We came, I suppose, about three times, and there was always some child, young girl, standing on the path, the crazy paved path, with their hands behind their backs and their heads bowed. And it was not a happy thing to see. But the other thing, they did some lovely handwork and they exhibited in our local show, and I thought, well, it can't be all bad if they're doing those sorts of things. But, of course, now we know it was bad. So, anyway.
Did you ever wonder if there was anything that you could do to change anything?
No. No, you had no idea. It was the government.
In almost every case, the home has failed these wayward children. The state must not fail them also. A problem child is a child with a problem. I believe there is no such thing as a bad girl.
Don't cry. I'm trying not to cry. I got makeup on. It's just unbelievable knowing that something like that could have happened in this town. This town's like a really quiet, friendly town, and knowing that that could happen, it was because of you girls that we had the opportunity, and the opportunity to get to know you girls was even better. So
getting to know you and as a township as well.
It's been wonderful. Yeah.
Okay, we'll be, you know, you got my email address, you mammy.
See you later. Thank you.
Be good.
A number of former Hay girls have begun legal action to sue for damages.
Take care.
Anthony Thurn, a solicitor for some of them, likens the abuse they suffered to war crimes, arising from an official culture of violence against children. A special thanks to Bonnie Durick and Lynette Aiken from the Paragirls group. Thanks also to playwright Alana Valentine and the Outback Theatre for Young People. Today's program was produced by Anne Arnold and the sound engineer was Mark Don. And last year it received a highly commended gong in the radio category at the Human Rights Commission Awards. For more information about today's program, as well as audio, just go to the Hindsight webpage. That's abc.net.au/rn/hindsight. And do join us here again on Hindsight next week for more excavation into the past from all around the world.
New South Wales wants to curb juvenile crime with youth conduct orders.
kids are told to stay away from dodgy mates and to follow strict behaviour programs to stop antisocial activities. The aim is to prevent young people ending up in court and in the lockup. But could these orders criminalise adolescents for being, well, adolescent? In the National Interest, with me, Peter Mayers. Download or stream this program from the Radio National website.